Continuing to look at the powerful words of Jesus, and this morning I want to invite you to this story in which Jesus talks about the heart of worship that pleases God. You might think, well, this is kind of an unusual time and place for Jesus to talk about worship, but this morning I want to talk about the background and kind of a little bit about this story. There's so much in this story that I want to look at this morning, and I know we can't look at all of it, but I want to look at the background of it, and then I want us to look at Jesus' words about worship. The story that I want to draw your attention to takes place at the side of Jacob's well. It's found in John chapter 4, and there's a conversation between a woman and Jesus, and that conversation is recorded for us, and within that, Jesus' words about worship. So would you stand with me, and if you want to read along, I'm going to read starting at verse 4 and read through 26. If you're comfortable to stand, please do, and if not, it's okay. I just invite sometimes us to do that when we read the Word, and we can have great respect for the Word, whether we're standing or seated. But this morning, I invite you to hear this great story, and we're going to look a little bit about the relationship between a Samaritan and a Jew, and then especially what Jesus said about worship. John chapter 4, verse 4 says, "Now he had to go through Samaria, so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, 'Will you give me a drink?' His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, 'You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans.' Jesus answered her, 'If you knew the gift of God and who it was that asked you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water.' 'Sir,' the woman said, 'you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his flocks and herds?' And Jesus answered, 'Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a well of water, welling up to eternal life.' The woman said to him, 'Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water.' He told her, 'Go back and call your husband and come back.' 'I have no husband,' she replied. And Jesus said to her, 'You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is quite true.' 'Sir,' the woman said, 'I can see that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem.' Jesus declared, 'Believe me, woman, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth.'" Thank you. You may be seated. This great story, as I said, has a lot in it, a lot of different things that we could look at and focus on this morning. Certainly one of the most important is what Jesus said about being the living water, and how Jesus declares in this story that he has something to give to this woman and to all of us that we can find nowhere else. We know that there was a great deal of animosity and tension between the Samaritan and the Jews. Kind of the background of this particular story illustrates and highlights a little bit that unspoken tension, sometimes spoken tension, between these two groups of people that live in what we call present-day Israel. There are three basic provinces in Jesus' day of Jewish people. There was up in the north in that pink area, Galilee, where Jesus grew up and spent a good part of his life and a good part of his ministry. That was his home area. It kind of went over to the Sea of Galilee, and And so many of the stories from the Gospels take place in Galilee. And then the green area on the bottom is what we call Judea. And that is also a province. And Jesus spent a lot of time, of course, in Judea, which Jerusalem is in that area. And many of the places that we read about in the stories found in the four Gospels. But in the middle is that purple area called Samaria. And Jesus went there several times. There's several times that we have a story that illustrate or highlight that he was in Samaria for one reason or another. But his time in Samaria, there's not very much of it. In fact, when you kind of lay out the time he was in Galilee, the time he was in Judea, when was he in Samaria? Pretty much only when he was going from one to the other. But we don't have a lot of interaction of Jesus with Samaritan people. We do have a few stories, and we can gain from them kind of a heart of God about people and reaching out to others. We know that in Jesus' day, there was particularly a lot of tension between the Samaritans and especially the people that lived in Judea. The history of the tension goes way back into the Old Testament, and the son of Solomon, Rehoboam, and what happened when his life came to an end, and a difference of who should be king, and the 12 tribes of Israel at that time, there was a split, and the 10 tribes to the north kind of became their separate entity. They became what we think of in the Old Testament as the nation of Israel, the southern two tribes, although it didn't exactly divide exactly, but roughly like that. The southern two tribe became the tribe of Judah, and what we think of in the Old Testament as the Judah and the Israelites at that time, or the nation of Israel. Well, those two groups continued to exist side by side or above and below each other, but there were tensions that continued from that time on and continued all throughout the Old Testament and up until the time of Jesus. It says in verse 4, now Jesus had to go through Samaria. Now, if you look at that term, now, he had to go through Samaria. It would tell you that he had to go through Samaria, that there was some reason why normally he wouldn't go through Samaria. You could just kind of see underneath the surface without them really explaining why, that Jesus going through Samaria was a notable event. It was something that would get the attention of the gospel writer. Well, it's not that Jesus wanted to go through Samaria or he had good reasons to go through Samaria. But if you go through Samaria and you're a Jew, it has to be that you have to. And you kind of see that in this story. He had to go through Samaria. Jesus felt and experienced and even incorporated into his teaching and his ministry some of the tensions that were very evident in that day. In fact, he taught us some really important lessons through the tensions with the Samaritans. Some of the principles that he knew are so very important for the people of God, whether they're Jews, whether they're Samaritans, and today, if we're going to be genuine Christians. He taught principles of goodness and kindness through the story of a Samaritan. You remember, for example, one example is the great parable that Jesus taught of what is he named? The Good Samaritan. We call him the Good Samaritan. Most people do. Anyway, who was the Good Samaritan? Well, he's the only one who stopped and helped the guy that had been beaten and left for dead on the road. The Jews went right on by. The priest and the Levi, they were too busy to help somebody who had been beaten and left battered. And, but who is it that stopped and help the man? It was a Samaritan. Again, this is a parable, a story, but it shows kind of the heart of Jesus. He knew about the tensions that existed in his day, but yet he used that to illustrate the heart of God. Who was a neighbor to this man? And of course, the answer was the one who had mercy, the one who stopped and helped. And so you can just even see in Jesus' teaching kind of the background of the issue with the Samaritans and these things that are going on. So Jesus is passing through Samaria and he stops according to chapter 4. He's actually going north from Judea back to Galilee, it says. And about 30 miles north of Jerusalem is a little town in Jesus' day. It was called Sychar. And very close to Sychar was an area that Jacob had given to his son Joseph in his last words as a blessing and a this will be for your sons to live in this land, and about 30 miles north of Jerusalem. And there, Jacob, we're told at some point, a well was dug and built and put in, and it was a substantial well, and it became called Jacob's Well. And this is the place that Jesus talks as he's traveling north. Now, again, Jesus is going to use a very average day's event to teach us something very important. So he arrives at the well. We're told that it's noon. It's the sixth hour. It's 12 o'clock. And Jesus apparently is there. And we think that he got there first. And it says here, Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. I don't know how long Jesus waited there. I don't know if Jesus knew what was going to happen. You know, people wonder, does Jesus know everything that's going to happen? I mean, we believe that now because he's in heaven and he's taken on the fullness of every and laying down on the cross, fully human and fully divine. And we know that he knows everything today, but I don't know about here. But whatever the case, he sat at the well, and apparently he didn't drink anything. I don't know, maybe he didn't have what he needed to draw the water. I kind of doubt that, but whatever is possible. We know that Jesus was with a group of people because we know that his disciples had gone into town to get food. So it wasn't that Jesus was alone, but maybe he was just waiting for them to come back from town. I'm not sure about that, but he's sitting there and he's waiting. And sometime later, it says, a Samaritan woman, verse 7, came to draw water. And so then you have this encounter, you have this experience, you have this conversation between Jesus and this Samaritan woman. I remind you three things about the encounter between these two people. Number one is a Samaritan. Now, most Jewish people did not easily talk to and associate with Samaritan people. It's like across the tracks, or worse. It's kind of like we don't talk to those people because of what they've done and what they believe, and they just avoided them. And that's what most Jews did to Samaritans. They talked bad about them, they talked down to them, and boy, if you had to talk to one, you only did it because you had to. So you have a Samaritan, and then you have a second thing about the Samaritan. It's a Samaritan woman, and she's all alone. A Jewish man did not talk to a Jewish woman alone. Generally, the culture, the norms. But here you have this Samaritan woman who's alone, and Jesus engages her in conversation. Now, we don't have those norms in our culture today. Men and women talk together and that kind of thing. But this would have been an unclean type thing for Jesus to do. If there would have been any Jews around there, let me tell you, they would have noticed and they would have taken exception to Jesus doing this. How could he just talk so freely to a Samaritan and a Samaritan woman? And then we know later from the context of the story what more and what background this woman had. I mean, what in the world was Jesus thinking? All these things, and here he is just sitting and talking freely and sharing with this woman. This even seemed to surprise her. You look back at her words and how she responds. It says, the Samaritan woman said to him in verse 9, you are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. I mean, she's kind of surprised by that. You know, she comes to get her water. Some people say that that was unusual for her to come alone, to come at noon, because that's not the time of the day that most women came to draw water. I'm not sure about that, but she was alone. And that may say something about her life and about her relationships and all those things. But whatever, she seems to be quite surprised by the fact that this Jewish man, number one, spoke to her, and number two, would continue on this conversation. And so, and then later on in verse 27, we have the reaction of the disciples when they come onto the scene. After this story takes place, it says, then his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. But no one asked, what do you want? And then look at the last part of that verse, or why are you talking with her? I mean, you just hear it kind of beneath the surface of the story, this shock and surprise about this woman, and why would Jesus do this? Well, I guess the first half of my sermon is this point. Why would Jesus do this? Well, the reason is that Jesus loves people. No matter who they are, no matter where they've been, no matter what their experiences are, Jesus loves people. In fact, there's so many stories in the Gospels that tell us that Jesus cares deeply about people. I'm going to paraphrase instead of going into everything that Jesus said to her, because we're going to look at some of it. But I want to paraphrase, what did Jesus say to this Samaritan woman with five husbands and a man she's living with? He said, I know who you are, I know about your past, and I care about you. Those are the three things that Jesus says to this woman. I know who you are. I know who you are. You don't have to wonder if I really know who you are. I know who you are. I know where you've been. I know what you've struggled with. I know where you have failed terribly. I know where you have been hurt. I know where your life has totally been a wreck. And I care about you. And that to me is one thing that comes out of this story. And there's many things in this story that are beautiful to me, but it's the heart of Jesus about people. He wasn't afraid to talk to this woman. He wasn't afraid to show her that he cared about her. Jesus sensed a deep need within her. He knew what to say to her. He knew what to ask her. He knew exactly how to respond to this woman. See, somehow an amazing God in heaven knows exactly what we need. He knows exactly where we're at, and he shows such kindness and compassion to her. Verse 19 says, Sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. This is the woman's response to Jesus telling her, I know who you are. I know all this stuff. The Samaritan woman seems like she's changing the subject. And, you know, I've read different people's ideas about this story, and that might be true. I mean, it does seem to be quite a change of subject. I mean, Jesus almost lovingly or whatever confronts her and says, you know, I go back and call your husband. I have no husband. And Jesus calls her on it. Yes, you do. You've had five of them. And the man you're with is not. I mean, but that's not the tone of voice Jesus used. He used a tone of voice that calls that woman to know that he had care in his love and his voice. You know, Jesus spoke the truth in love. Speaking the truth without love just hurts people. But speaking the truth in love can change hearts. And that's what Jesus did here. He spoke the truth in love. And her reaction in verse 19 seems a little bit odd. She seems to change the subject as if maybe she's wanting to avoid talking any more about her past. That's possible. Some people think that. And some people think that, well, maybe she realized that this man who was willing to talk to her at the well had something very, very deep and important to tell her. And so she asked what seems like could be a sincere question about worship and about God and about connecting to God. It may be that this woman truly wanted to connect with God. She really wanted to know, is God real? You know, sometimes we get through life and we get in all kinds of circumstances and we forget that God is real. We forget that he's out there, or we wonder, is God there? Does God really know where I'm at? Is God real in my life and my situation? I wonder if a woman here who's been married five times might have felt that way. There's no way that God can be real. There's no way that I can connect to a God with the life that I've lived. But Jesus gives her another answer. Jesus also listens to what she says, and she talks about Jerusalem and about worship, and she brings this up. Well, you know, our people only worship here, Mount Gerizim, and again, 30 miles from Jerusalem, and your people have to worship in Jerusalem. You see, that was part of this tension between the Jews and the Samaritans. Samaritans wanted to have their own temple at one time. They wanted to have their own places of worship. They wanted to worship Yahweh, but they kind of didn't want to do it the way that the people in Jerusalem did. They didn't want the authority of the priest and the temple. They kind of wanted to have independence, and that did not sit well with the Jews. So there was always this tension. You can't worship God up there in Shechem. You got to come to Jerusalem for the feast and the festivals and worship God. And if you don't, then you're really rejecting God and you're rejecting us. So that was part of the tension. And so she seems to ask this, what may be an innocent question about where you worship. I mean, how dare that anybody would worship other than in Jerusalem? But you know, when Jesus responds to this question, whether it was fully sincere or she was changing the subject or whatever, I kind of come to my second half of what I want to say this morning, and that is, what does Jesus say to her in response to that? Well, basically what Jesus does is get to the heart of what worship needs to be. It almost seems like a real change of subject in this story, and it is. All of a sudden, we have a shift to Jesus talking about the importance and the meaning of what worship really is. And he describes for us something very important. You notice that Jesus doesn't really respond to her question about where to worship. I mean, I guess he does, because he says, well, someday you won't worship here and you won't worship in Jerusalem. He kind of says that doesn't matter. You know, the place of worship doesn't really matter. I think if we could just bring right here Jesus down and we could all talk to him and ask him some questions, I think if we'd say, Jesus, does it matter where we worship? You know, it's my guess that he would say, no. Well, how about when we worship, Jesus? When do you think we should worship? And, you know, what did Jesus care about worship? What does he tell us is important? It's not the external things that we might feel important are and or feel important to us, and maybe we feel strongly about it. It's not style. It's certainly not about the method of worship and what you do when you're together or anything like that. Jesus doesn't talk about that at all. What Jesus talks about is the depth of the heart. And he says what's really important to the heart of God and the kind of worship that pleases God is all about what's on the inside of who you are. And if what's on the inside of who you are, deep down in what you believe and how you respond to God, if that's right, then that's what pleases the Father. That's what makes God happy. That's what somehow humanity and our frailness and our ugliness, how we can be pleasing to an infinite, perfect God. We respond to Him based on who He is. We believe that He is who He says He is. And we give Him the glory and the honor that's due Him. We have a reverence within our hearts that reflect that we believe that God is awesome and higher than us and other than us. And we worship Him from the depth of something on the deep inside. Maybe we'll call it faith. What God wants from us are hearts of faith that respond to Him and the wonder of who He is. It's important that we hear the words of Jesus and what He says about worship. There's so many things that we talk about with worship. And you know, if you're around this church or any other church, everybody has opinions about worship. It's so good to come back and hear what Jesus said about worship. You know, I read every reference to worship in the New Testament. This is the only place that Jesus talks about worship. He mentions the word worship in a couple of contexts. He quotes one time when he's tempted in the wilderness, for example, and Satan comes and says, bow down and worship. I mean, what does Jesus say? He says, don't you know, haven't you heard that we're to worship God only? He quoted about worship. But this is the only place that Jesus talks about worship. He doesn't talk about when or where. He doesn't focus, but he focuses on the deep part of the heart, of spirit and truth and what that means. Here Jesus seems to get to the heart of something. He says God is spirit and worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. And so today I just kind of throw it out to you. What does it mean for you to worship God in spirit and in truth? I mean, that seems like a little bit vaguer, more vague words maybe than we might feel comfortable with, in spirit and in truth. That's what God's looking for from you and I, whatever that is, whatever that means. We know that God is a spirit. He was the creator. Everything that came after God was part of the creation. He's the only thing. He's the only being. He's the only entity that is spirit, that is completely spirit. He was not created. He always is. And so right there, He is above and beyond anything or anyone or any part of creation. He is a spirit, and we must worship Him in spirit and truth. There's something about how we understand God and how we process faith that should acknowledge the spirit nature of God. That I'm trying to describe it, trying to get us to think about it, to understand what it means to worship a God that's spirit. I mean, it's so unlike everything we have. It's unlike physical idols. It's unlike the temptation of worshiping money. It's unlike the temptation to worship self, pride, fame, any of the things that man can get occupied with. None of those are spirit. None of them are God.
He has a place that only belongs to Him and should only belong in our hearts to an infinite, awesome, eternal God. If anything else is in that place, then we cannot know Him and be pleasing to Him in worship. God is spirit, and we must worship Him in spirit and in truth. Nothing Jesus talks about with rituals. In fact, Jesus doesn't talk about any external expressions. He only talks really about what goes on deep inside the heart. The heart is where worship generates from. It's from the inside out that we worship God. It all begins down in some place that we call that center of faith, of responding to the claims of God, that worship begins. It's in hearing truth, in knowing what God has said and choosing to believe, that faith begins and worship begins. Without that place of connecting truth to faith, there's no way that our worship can be meaningful or can mean anything to God or to us. We can put on the external signs of worship. Any of us can pretend. But without the faith deep in the heart, that's where responsiveness begins to God. That's where our worship must begin. And that's what we've got to focus on in our worship. It's what's going on the inside. Not what's going on with our neighbor or the person across the pew or somebody else, the young or the old or anything else. It's got to be me and God in my heart before an awesome, eternal, infinite God. Jesus is talking here about the very depth of where faith begins and where worship begins, where we respond to God out of this pool of the awesomeness of God and being connected to Him. The heart is so important. Something is to emanate from our faith that comes out in worship. Something has got to begin deep inside and come out, whether it comes out with our voices or it comes out with our hands or it comes out in actions, however it comes out, it's got to start in the deep place of faith. If you don't have that deep place of faith and connection to God, then the externals won't matter. Won't matter what show you can feel or put on or listen to or be a part of. What matters is that your heart is right with God. And if it is, if God has been able to deal with those issues deep inside of you, then your worship will be pleasing to God wherever and whatever it is, if your heart is right. From a core of faith and recognition of the worthiness of God comes a natural outflow of something, an outflow of respect, an outflow of ascribing to God, maybe an outflow of music or noise or testimony. All these things that are described in the Scriptures are outflows of something on the inside. So I guess because Jesus only talked about worship in this context, it kind of makes me think sometimes we really get off the track about worship. Maybe it's better to come back and hear what Jesus says about the heart and how important that is, the most important. He is worthy of our deepest heartfelt praise and responsiveness. God is awesome. He is spirit. He's not like the created world. He's infinite. He's almost indescribable, but yet we try. He's the being of all power. He's all powerful. He is always present. He's omniscient. He knows everything. His nature is love. His mercy is described as unending. His grace is free. Our God is an awesome God. He reigns from heaven above with wisdom, power, and love. Our God is an awesome God. Maybe I don't feel that, maybe I don't say that, but I probably should more often than that. Go to that next slide, the words are on there of that song. Go to the next one, whatever it is. Our God is an awesome God. Do you know that today? Do you know that He's amazing and powerful and wonderful and loving and merciful and forgiving and patient and kind? Do you know that He gave His only Son to die for my sins and for yours? You know that He gave everything that He could out of a nature that's infinite? Did He do enough for you? Is there anything else God needs to do before deep within us comes out this fountain of praise, this fountain of thanksgiving, I'm not talking about expressiveness. Some people are expressive and some people aren't. That's part of human nature. I'm talking about what's on the inside. I want to challenge you this morning, whether you're expressive or you're not, or how you see worship. It's on the inside that God is looking for. He's looking for people that worship Him in spirit and in truth. He's looking for people that have lost their sense of pride. He's looking for people that have lost and given to Him that sense within them that they don't need God. There's so many things that come between us and true worship. One is that pride. Pride is such a killer to experience the work of God in our hearts and in the greatness of God when we think about all the things that can keep us from hearing God's Spirit. A spirit of pride is like that. A spirit of stubbornness is like that. When we are stubborn, when we hold on to what we have or what we used to have or what we want to have, and it just blocks up the wonder of God in our spirits and our lives. It can be a spirit of bitterness, spirit of unforgiveness. All these things that we've heard and we know, all those things keep us from sensing and responding to the awesomeness of God. I want to say to you today, God cares deeply about what's on the inside of our hearts. So much more than the external, although they can be important. But what He cares about is what's on the inside. May my life reflect a reverence for God. One more verse and then I'll bring it to an end. You know one of my favorite verses I quoted off is Hebrews chapter 12. If you would go to that slide, this is one of my core verses of my life and what I believe and what I feel so deeply on the inside. This is what I need to be. Since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. A spirit of thankfulness needs to be a part of who we are, not a spirit of grumbling, not a spirit of complaining, but a spirit of thankfulness to God. There is acceptable worship and there's unacceptable worship to God. It's not based on what I might see in you, what you might see in your neighbor. Way down in the depth of your heart can be a fountain that flows with joy, a fountain that acknowledges God for who He is, a fountain of joy that no one can take away. I want to encourage you this morning. I want to have a heart that pleases the Father. I want my worship to be pleasing to Him. In closing, there's three I understand as I read about worship in the Bible, there's three areas of worship that are important in our lives. Number one is this one. It's the heart that matters. It's where it starts. It's where it counts. It's where it generates. The second area is in Romans chapter 12 and talks about being living sacrifice. Romans chapter 12 talks about how God wants us to daily be a living sacrifice to Him. This is your spiritual act of worship. When we use the word worship, one way is in the area of the heart. A second way is how we live daily. Again, how do we live? What's our relationship with people? What's our attitude? All those are a part of worship. You come to church on Sunday and smile real good and look good, but if you go home and treat your neighbor badly, your worship means nothing to God. Then the third area. So it's heart, it's how you live, and then third one is the one we usually think of real often. When I say worship, most of us think that's what we do when we come together on Sunday morning. We call that worship. And that is worship. It's very important. Very important. Corporate worship is a part of the history of God's people. All the way back in the Psalms. You just read over and over again the Psalms about how worship is important and all those things. You think of the book of Revelation in the very end, and that's where you find most references to worship in the New Testament. How it's going to be at the end times when all of us are gathered around the throne of God and worshiping God. It's a beautiful story of worship. You know, worship, there's a fullness to understanding worship, but it begins with a heart. I just wonder if we could sing that chorus in closing. That I go back on, if you would, a couple slides to that chorus. And we just let's sing a cappella this morning. I think most of us know this song. Our God is an awesome God. Would you stand with me if you can? And I'm going to invite you again to sing it with your tongues. And that's good, but even more important, sing it with your heart. Sing it with your heart. Say, God, how can my worship be more pleasing to you? What do you want in my life, in my heart, in my spirit? He's a great and a mighty and an awesome God, and he's worthy of our very best, whatever it is. Sing it with me, would you?